Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Outspoken with White and Jordan. 100% engagement.
It's a total disrespect.
Download Stand Well Back. Listen.
Jim White and Simon Jordan.
I don't see that view.
Outspoken with White and Jordan.
From the world's biggest sports radio station, Talk Sport.
Thanks for listening to Outspoken with White and Jordan. I'm Jim White, and today myself and Simon discussed the fact that a new independent regulator for the game is inching closer as the Football Governance Bill is introduced to Parliament today. Deemed an historic day for English football, but what will be the realistic outcome? A game changer to the reign in the Wild West, or a toothless waste of time? We speak to Culture Secretary Lucy Fraser. Meantime, the second point hit of the season for financial breaches has arrived after Nottingham Forest were deducted 4 points. But is it far from over in this season of asterisks? Stefan Borsen, FFP expert and former financial advisor to Manchester City, joins us live in studio. Plus, Dame Laura Kenny, Britain's most successful female Olympian, has announced her retirement from cycling. She joined us in studio to look back in her career. This is Outspoken with White and Jordan. We know that an independent regulator for the game inches closer as the Football Governance Bill is introduced to Parliament today. Now, I know you've got strong views on this, Simon. This is being deemed an historic day for English football, but the big question is, what will the realistic outcome of this be? Is it going to be a game changer to reign in the Wild West, or is it a toothless waste of time? Or is it a vehicle for votes in what is, after all, an election year? What do you think it is, Simon? Because no matter what, this thing is coming. This thing is on us today.
Yeah, it is. And it's been packaged in a certain way. And it's almost like that TV show back in the 1970s where Jesus of Nazareth was on a cross looking down saying, "Forgive them, Lord, they know not what they've done." With the idea that we need over-regulation of this game and governance to step into a scenario where it starts to strangle the game is ridiculous. If you look
at what football's allowed it to happen.
Exactly right. Precisely that, and incompetence and inefficiencies. The real battle is about distributions, about more money being paid into the pyramid. And why the independent regulator has value to me is because it can be used as an opportunity for Rick Parry and Trevor Birch to make up for the sins of the imbeciles that went before them that couldn't bridge the gap between what the Premier League was becoming and what they needed to get from it. So the battle about distribution is a valid one. The idea that a brilliant sport with a brilliant set of leagues that dominates world football, that in 1985 had 9 games being broadcast on terrestrial TV, had £1.3 million as its broadcast deal, had empty stadiums and football violence off the scale, now has billions coming into the game, is the world's most powerful league and some of the best football teams and best managers and best individuals playing in it, has 320 games being broadcast live every season, has football stadiums as like shining new pins, but has a few challenges, is somehow broken and needs a bunch of regulators to come in and strangle the life out of it, which is what regulators tend to do in dynamic industries, is bloody stupid. But it's brought it upon itself, and it's been dressed up as some fan-led revolution. Okay, be careful what you wish for, because there's a distinct possibility you might get it.
Yes, but here's the thing though, Simon. The key moment, surely, was the morning you and I were on with Danny Murphy, and we were talking about the Big Six breaking away, the Super League. There and then they killed themselves. And this is why this thing is happening, correct or incorrect?
This is why this thing got some more traction in the media. It was already being run by David Bernstein and other people previously to that, and it got some more energy. It got some more traction.
But
it got
that
some
brought more focus. About a fan-led review, brought about a regulator.
And I understand that. And I understand that to some extent that the energy that got put behind it, if you produce a fan-led review, then you'll get outcomes that are specifically about what the fans think should happen with football. And of course I get it. Of course I don't think that football is designed and created inside boardrooms. I'm a football fan firstly, and a football investor, secondly.
Right.
So with that in mind, I'm not stupid, but you also have to look at the reality of what is broken. What is the panacea that you think a regulator is going to bring? Do you think a regulator would stop Mel Morris from owning a football club? No, they wouldn't. Do you think that a regulator controlling the way that football starts to morph into something that becomes over-regulated? Because regulators do one thing, they regulate. That's the very nature of what they do. And you've got this brilliant industry that's made a few missteps that needs to reconstitute itself. And the flip side of that is how can it get distribution? Nobody, let me tell you something, be clear. Nobody in football wants a regulator, really. Rick Parry don't want a regulator, and neither does Trevor Birch. But what they want a regulator for is to use it as a leverage to get the Premier League to come to the table to distribute more revenues, because they don't want to. And neither would you if you were in the Premier League.
But Simon, I hear what you're saying. But when you look at the six key points, can you argue with any one of them? Number one, give fans a greater voice in the running of their clubs. What's wrong with that?
Well, it depends what you think that voice should be.
Fan engagement.
Well, fan engagement exists. You already have fans so vociferous. You have fans coming on this show and issuing manifesto demands to football clubs like Tottenham Hotspur. You have fans sitting down with owners of football clubs. Jim Ratcliffe walks through the door. What's the first thing he does? Engages with the fans. Do you want fans in the boardroom? No, you bloody don't.
No, you don't. But you don't want owners doing what they like when they like. I remember going out to Malaysia to interview Vincent Tan, who said, I want Cardiff to change from blue to red. Well, Vincent, they won't, so don't do it.
But that's a silliness. It's like back in the day, the Alams wanted to change the name to Hull Tigers or something. And what happens in the end is common sense prevails.
Are fans key to the game?
By the way, when Vincent Tan changed the kit to red, Cardiff got promoted, didn't they?
Didn't matter. They weren't having it.
No, fine. And what happened?
It was a major own goal by Vincent, and he knows that.
And what happened? They reverted to type, and Cardiff went back to their traditional blue. Number two,
promote financial sustainability, and we'll have the ability to fine clubs up to 10% of their turnover for non-compliance.
What is sustainability?
Hallelujah.
What is sustainability? Ultimately, I do think, I absolutely agree there needs to be more governance.
There you go.
I absolutely agree there should be better structures. And it makes me die with embarrassment on behalf of the FA. They're sitting on the sideline cheering this on, these bleeding idiots. They were supposed to be the de facto regulator of the game. They're going, let's all get an independent regulation. What are you doing then? Because you won't have a fight with the Premier League, because you want international fixtures and you want the players available to it, and you want the FA Cup to come alongside the Premier League. That's how poor you are.
Okay. Number three, ensure breakaway closed shop competitions such as the European Super League will be blocked. Thank God for that. We don't want to see that again.
So we want monopolies, do we?
No, but we don't want to see a European Super League rear its head again.
We want no competitive...
Involving English clubs.
No, we want the European Super League, insofar as it was a concept that had real legs to it in the longer game, to have meritocracy attached to it.
We don't want greedy clubs being greedier.
They're all greedy. Every football club is greedy. It wants more money. And if you qualify greed as being able to try and get the maximum you can out of something, then we're all greedy.
Okay, number four, implement strengthened owners and directors tests. Thank God for that. Look at Barry. No more Steve Dales. No, good.
Look, the Steve Dale situation is often a rock to fling at the ideal. Steve Dale is an exception. He's an aberration, and then you have to look at the reality of what he was allowed to achieve. For Steve Dale, you've got Mel Morris. Right, so Mel Morris is the perfect blueprint of an owner, massively financially well-heeled, Derby City football fan, and committed to being involved in the game. Who could have ever legislated for the idea that Mel Morris would either run out of money or appetite? You know, the bottom line is, do you want investment into sport? We've got the most investable league in the world. So what we're going to do, kill that in the exchange for a bit of balance, a bit of common sense. It'll settle down, but right now what we've got is a revolution rather than an evolution.
I'll keep this to the final point at this stage. They have to be equipped with backstop powers to impose a new deal on financial distributions.
Oh, yeah. Don't you remember backstop when it was being mooted around about Brexit, about the border in the Northern Ireland Sea? Backstop this, backstop that. Careful with backstop and what it actually means. Yes, it needs to have some teeth, because if it doesn't have some teeth, then the EFL are negotiating with their pants around their ankles and their chins hanging out. They need to have some form of credibility in the discussion. But this independent regulator... The deal for in distribution will be done. If I'm the Premier League, do you know when I'm going to do the deal? When I'm walking up to the court steps. That's what you do in life. You settle on the door of the court, because we don't live in a moral world where you're supposed to help your neighbour.
You said, and you agreed with me at the start there, football allowed for this to happen.
Did. Incompetence.
So this is why we've got it.
And that's right. This is why we've got it. And that's why football needs to be careful what it does to itself. You've got a situation now where you've got a PGML that implemented VAR, which was a good idea in a bad way, which is being implemented incorrectly, which is damaging the game. You've then got this financial regulation coming in, which will damage the game. If we're not careful, these are existential threats to the value of this game. These are dangerous times, but interesting ones. And it's about how significant operators within the game react to it rather than the background noise that politicians are making.
You're on form, aren't you? Just as you guys at Gatwick were telling me about last night, this is why you love it when Simon is on form, and he certainly is this morning. The regulator is here, guys, whether we like it or not.
The world's most dangerous download. Outspoken with White and Jordan. From the world's biggest sports radio station, Talk Sport.
We have a football finance headline in all the newspapers this morning. This is the back of the Times this morning. Forest Fury at 4-point deduction. Yep, it's happened. Nottingham Forest have been docked 4 points for breaching the Premier League's financial rules, despite having greater losses, we're told, than Everton, who were given a 6-point deduction. The punishment means that Forest drop into the drop zone below Luton, with 9 matches of the season remaining, after admitting a breach of the profitability and sustainability rules. Is it far from over, though, in this season of asterisks? Has football allowed itself to become a lawyer's playground? Alongside Simon this morning, FFP expert and former financial advisor to Manchester City. You know him, we know him, and he's become part of this show. Stefan Borsten joins us live. Stefan, good morning. Forest up in arms, should they be?
It's difficult to say whether how they've been treated because the thing is changing all the time. So we're in a very fluid situation where each decision that comes out sets the parameters and the authorities for the next one. And because it's so fluid, it's quite hard to gauge whether they've been fortunate with the decision or harshly treated. What would you say? I think they've been treated okay because, and I'll tell you the big thing that I think the Premier League could have done. They could have gone very hard on recklessness in terms of the spending. And so they could have said, and it does come across in the Commission's decision, that Nottingham Forest knew that they were going to breach. And all of their internal models said that they were going to breach. This was known in September 22, in December 22.
Well, they would have breached. If they had stayed in the Championship, they would have breached in the Championship because they lost £45 million in 21-22.
Sure.
They decided to spend £170-odd million on transfers. They decided to put their wage bill up by 70, 80 million quid. They took a view on not selling Brennan Johnson. And they decided not to have a shirt sponsor for the best part of a year. All of these decisions, they would have known. If they didn't know, then they're incompetent. But they would have been able to project that we are going to be in a situation where we're going to breach financial fair play. We know we're allowed to lose 61 million quid, irrespective of the unfairness of it, whether carrying Championship losses forward is a fair thing to do or not. That's a different discussion.
Right.
You know the rules. You decided to spend 40-odd million quid, probably more than you needed to spend, on player transfers.
Yeah.
You decided to put wage bills up to a level that were unsustainable, and you decided to not to be commercially adroit. If you're going to sell Brennan Johnson for 47 million quid, which is the lesser two evils, sell him for 35 million quid and carve a deal out with some back-end payments, or get relegated the following season through parish because you don't stay in the division. I tell you what, I'll sell Brennan Johnson for 15 million quid less because it's worth more to me in the longer game. They chose not to.
Right.
They chose not to.
Stefan, I'm looking at the messages coming in now that you've joined us again, and they're in full flow. And one recurring theme is Forest breach was higher than Everton's, right? So how come they've been deducted fewer points?
Well, it was higher in absolute terms, but of course the limit that they had was significantly lower than Everton's. And the circumstances around that breach were different. And, you know, ultimately, Everton, yes, they breached by only £20 million, but it was a breach, first of all, after huge amounts of allowances were taken off, and secondly, above the 105 limit. Obviously, Nottingham Forest were working to a limit of £61 million. And so, yes, in absolute terms, their breach was £35 million versus 20. You know, you can't shy away from that. But, of course, they were working to a lower limit. They also had the situation where they were getting promotion and therefore they felt needed to invest in the squad. So I don't think that you can just take one factor, be it the absolute pound breach over their individual limit, and say, therefore, they should suffer a certain penalty. But in any event, I mean, actually, when you break it down, arguably, Nottingham Forest have had a higher sanction than Everton on appeal. Because if you break down what the Everton appeal sanction was, it was 6 points. Now, we know that at least one of those points must have been in relation to the misrepresentation that they made to the Premier League. And the misrepresentation is not my word. First of all, it's the word that's used in the appeal. But their own barrister called their information to the Premier League objectively misleading. That was their barrister's words. So at least one point of the Everton sanction must have been for that. Therefore, the other five must have been for the breach. Well, if you look at the Nottingham Forest sanction is actually 6 points. But what's then happened is because of their cooperation and their early admission, which was not the case with Everton, it was reduced by 2 points. So on a like-for-like basis, arguably it's 6 plays 5. Six for Notts Forest and 5 for Everton on a like-for-like. It's just that Everton had the aggravating factor around this objectively misleading information. And on the other hand, Nottingham Forest had some mitigation, which was the early admission and the cooperation.
Yeah.
So although when you look at it, you go 4 plays 6.
Right.
Actually,
right.
It's not quite right. It's more like 6 probably plays 4, because there's a good chance that in the appeal's mind, and I'll come on to an important point here that Everton fans are going to shout at me about, it's probable in the appeal's mind that 2 of the points were relating to this objectively misleading information that they gave to the Premier League. But the problem is, the commission pointed out that in the Everton appeal decision, it doesn't specify that 2 of the points were because of that. It's quite bland. It comes out with this 6 points.
Okay.
The Nottingham Forest decision suggests that the Everton appeal was 3 base points plus 3 extra points for the size of the breach and for this misleading information.
Okay, but nonetheless, Everton appealed and got it reduced. Number two, are Forest going to appeal? Presumably they will.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, there's been a bit of rumour that they've done a deal. I don't think there's any sign that they've done a deal not to appeal.
What do you mean they've done a deal?
Done a deal not to appeal. But I don't think there's any sign that that's the case.
Why would they do that?
Well, I don't think they would, and I don't think it's within the gift of the Independent Commission anyway to do that kind of deal.
So you'd appeal if you were Marinakis, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think to suggest that as part of a thought process in the actual adjudication that we won't appeal if you give us a reasonable sentence, which is kind of the underlying assertion there, is probably quite preposterous, because it then changes the dynamic of the whole process of A, an Independent Commission, and then B, an appeal process. It's a preordained decision-making process. Of course you're going to appeal. Why would you not appeal? Because ultimately, this is not some football fine where you turn around and get more. You're only going to get a situation where you might get less.
So
or you might get the same.
What's
and it's worth
then,
a quarter
Stephen?
Million pound throw of the dice.
Yeah. Okay,
Forest fans are listening in numbers. I'm looking at the messages. What's the end game they're asking?
Well, you know, they're not going to get more than 2 points back when you read the decision. But there is a possibility that they could get 1 or 2. It's very hard to say. You know, when we looked at the Everton situation, none of us would have known that one of the key arguments that Everton were going to bring up as part of their, 10-9 argument was that actually the Premier League never even asked the Independent Commission to find that it breached the duty of good faith. Nobody even knew that. And so we couldn't foresee what the appeal might be. If I was in Nottingham Forest's position, what I would do now is I would go and get a new barrister. And Nick DeMarco won't thank me for that comment. But I think if you bring in a fresh pair of eyes and somebody that's not wedded to the arguments that you've just run a week ago in the Independent Commission, you may have a better chance of convincing an appeal board of some new arguments. And that's what Everton did, not necessarily by design, but that's what they did. They went and brought in a big hitter and sort of ran a lot of the arguments all over again with a slightly different angle to them, and two of them landed. And that's all you need to do to get a point back. And so I think it's a free hit, I would say, for Nottingham Forest, because I don't believe, although there is a piece in the paper today that says there is a theoretical possibility that the sanction can be increased, and that is true. I think in reality, it's not going to happen. And partly it's not going to happen because it would require the Premier League to go on the offensive in the appeal. And I think what you can see in the Everton appeal is that the Premier League were quite passive in there. They'd done their work in the first round. They'd fought very hard. And actually, Nottingham Forest appear in their statement to be very surprised by how hard the Premier League fought in their case. But I think that's perfectly normal, because you have to understand that the Premier League goes into these cases in front of an independent commission as a claimant. And the other side, the club, is a respondent.
Right.
And it's there in black and white on the front of the decision.
Yeah.
Claimant, respondent.
Gee, we're going to hit a break. You said moments ago you might say something that Everton fans won't be happy with.
Well, everything I say Everton fans won't be happy with. But
Do you want to give me the crux of that at the moment?
I can't remember what the point was now. Because I think we just touched on it in terms of that 6v5, to be honest.
Got you.
Right? That there is a perception that it's 6 plays 4 and Everton have therefore been disadvantaged. I don't think it's right. I think the reality is that it's actually 6 plays 4 or 5 the other way round. But it's just that Nottingham Forest had this fantastic mitigation that Everton just didn't have.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Danger. Flammable exchanges ahead. Outspoken with White and Jordan. From the world's biggest sports radio station, Talk Sport.
As we have been reporting on TalkSport, the Football Governance Bill is being introduced to Parliament today, with the end game being an independent regulator for football. TalkSport's chief football correspondent Alex Crook is down at Leighton Orient today for a press day ahead of all of this. And Alex right now is alongside the Culture Secretary, Lucy Fraser. Alex, all yours.
Yeah, good afternoon, Jim. Good afternoon, Simon. It's being billed as a historic day for football. No surprise, it is a hive of activity down here at Leighton Orient, as you say. Delighted to be joined by the Culture Secretary, Lucy Fraser, one of the driving forces behind this bill being introduced to Parliament as we speak. Lucy, in your opinion, why is it such a historic day for the sport?
Oh, well, I think it is a historic day. And the reason is because football is so important to the country. And it's one of our massive cultural exports as well. Premier League worth £6 billion. But it also matters, you know, to people in every community up and down the country. It's not just about that game on a Saturday. It's the heart of many communities. And what we've seen, unfortunately, is clubs going to administration, causing huge devastation to their communities. And what we want to do is stop that. We want to ensure that those clubs are financially sustainable into the future. That's why we're bringing in a football regulator through this bill in Parliament that we're introducing today, in the interests of fans, and those are communities across the country.
And Leighton Orient, in many ways, a fitting venue, because this is a club themselves who've been hit by financial hardship. Simon Jordan back in the studio. Simon, I know you've been a little bit sceptical about the independent regulator. What would you like to ask Lucy?
I don't think I need to ask the Secretary anything. I think she's got her own views about what she thinks the independent regulator is going to be. I have reservations about it. I don't think politicians really understand sport. I don't think they really are interested in understanding. I think the government illustrated their lack of understanding about the football pyramid during the COVID situation, when they looked at the Premier League and felt that every other club, as a result of the Premier League spend, could afford to manage its way through the COVID crisis. But I also think it's a strange one. I mean, regulation in an industry, which ultimately has proven to be relatively successful. Most businesses have casualties. Most industries have casualties. And whilst there's a unique position of football, my concern is once you start to regulate an industry and over-regulate it, you start to stifle and to stymie the commercial thinking which has brought it to the point that it's at now, which on the whole is pretty successful given the journey that the football's been on over the last 40 years.
I'm very happy to respond to that. And of course, football is world leading. Premier League is worth £6 billion and the envy of the world. And we absolutely don't want to interfere with that. We want to ensure that it continues to thrive. The issue is that for decades, people have been talking about the fact that there are issues in football and has really encouraged football to sort itself out. For example, how much money flows through from the Premier League into the EFL, into the other leagues. Unfortunately, as we saw last week, the Premier League didn't even make an offer to the EFL in terms of that money flowing through. I've been saying for months, please, please sort this out. But unfortunately, football hasn't. And we have said if they don't, we will bring in a football regulator. And so that's what we've done. And just in terms of the point of understanding what's happening in football, my team and I have done a huge amount of engagement with all of the leagues, with the fan groups to understand, you know, a bill that will work, put forward a bill that works for everybody. And I think that's what we've brought forward today.
Lucy, would you say then, just listening to you there, that football really has brought this upon itself, that because of dragging its feet regarding this area, the government stepped in, you've stepped in, and it's down to the politicians to accelerate the pace of this?
I would say that I'm a Conservative and I'm not naturally pro regulation and commercial sectors, but we have for decades. I mean, the Labour Party talked about this when they were in power. You know, we've had a fan-led review. We've been putting pressure on football. Unfortunately, it hasn't managed to, you know, we saw last week, he couldn't even put an offer on the table to the EFL. And so, yes, that's why the government has stepped in.
You would also argue, presumably, it could be said that you see this as a vote winner in an election year.
We've been talking about this for some time. It was in our 2019 manifesto to have a fan-led review. You're right, it's hugely popular. It's hugely popular because it's the right thing to do, because we want to make sure that football remains sustainable in the interests of fans. And we want to make sure as a government that we support fans up and down the country.
The one thing that I think myself and Lucy will concur on is the need for distribution, fairer distributions or better distributions.
Yeah.
The irony of the situation is that the incompetency of football have allowed a situation. But once the independent regulator, once the financial distribution has been achieved, and that's the benefit of an independent regulator because it's used as a stalking horse, you then get into the territory of an independent regulator starts to look at regulation. And in most industries, if you look at most industries, a regulator, most industries look at them and go, not comfortable with them. And I think we've got a dynamic football pyramid. Once distribution is achieved and a bit more governance, a regulator is a very bad thing.
What would you say to that, Lucy?
Well, what I would say is, look, I have taught had many conversations with the Premier League and with the EFL and with the FA. Because we don't want to over-regulate. And this is a very, very tight bill, which is all concerned with financial distribution, with financial sustainability. We're not getting involved in the game at all. This is just about financial sustainability. It's about setting a framework to ensure that clubs are sustainable throughout the leagues. And it's also light touch in the sense that we're recognising that the leagues are doing some of this work already, and the regulator must understand and work with the leagues to ensure there isn't duplication of work. So I'm very comfortable that we've settled this in a very good place, which will ensure financial sustainability but won't interfere too much in football as a whole.
Lucy, can I ask you about this terminology backstop, which we saw mooted lots and lots of times during the Brexit debate around the Northern Ireland border and things of that nature. So it becomes an almost taboo terminology. But the teeth that the independent regulator will have. We know that the Premier League don't particularly want to give any money to the EFL. It's like Turkey's voting for Christmas. They generate the revenue, they want to keep it. And that's true in most commercial entities. But with the regulator now having the ability to potentially to involve themselves in forcing a decision, how big are those teeth going to be?
So the regulator will have teeth. You know, I would still encourage the Premier League and the FL to come to a deal because, as you say, it's a backstop. It's not a front stop. So if they come to a deal, there'll be a period of bedding in where that deal should continue to
but in the event they can't, Lucy, in the event they can't, because these are commercial animals that are sitting there going, I'm not going to give you something unless I have to. So with that in mind, how big are the teeth going to be from an independent regulator force a situation on the Premier League to be able to give up significant revenues? And we're talking about £300-400 million a year from the Premier League.
If they don't come to a deal, the legislation will set out that the backstop can be triggered immediately. And so the regulator will then start that process to consider the distributions.
And how long does that process take? And is it challengeable by the Premier League?
There is obviously a process in there to ensure that the right outcomes are taken, and the regulator needs to ensure that his objectives are fulfilled, that football is sustainable across the board. The Premier League would put an offer, and the EFL would put an offer, and the regulator would take matters forward.
Lucy, as often happens on our show, we pride ourselves with this big audience that we have and many people getting in touch as Simon and I discuss an issue, discuss a topic, and in this instance, we're discussing the regulator with you. There's one there. What on earth are we doing putting our beautiful game in the hands of politicians? You get the theme here, Lucy. They're worried that Parliament's in the same conversation as the Premier League, as a football pyramid. There's another. I bet you Lucy Fraser doesn't even have a team. Well, do you? Who do you support, Lucy?
My son is an avid Chelsea supporter, which I'm sure many of your listeners will have views on. But look, politicians are not getting involved in football. What we're doing is setting up a regulator. The regulator will be independent of government. It isn't, as you say, for politicians to get involved. But what we're doing is responding to an issue. That issue is that clubs across the country are unfortunately going into administration. Now, I'm getting contacted by fans. I was recently contacted by a Reading fan saying, please, we need some help. You know, parliamentarians who are obviously representing their constituents from across the board are welcoming this because, you know, it's in their constituents' interest that their local club doesn't go under. We're just trying to make sure that fans stay at the heart of the game, that communities are supported, and that football continues to thrive.
Lucy, just finally, and I don't mean to sound impertinent, but I'll put the question to you. An independent regulator, can politicians be trusted with this?
Yes, but I would assure people who are listening to this with the comfort that politicians are just setting the framework, and then there will be an independent regulator who will be making the decisions and making those decisions in conversation with and liaising with the leagues themselves. So I don't think people should be too concerned. And I would just like to stress.
But Lucy, you guys will be the intellectual capital behind the appointments. You guys as politicians will be the intellectual capital behind who becomes the regulators and the people of authority within the independent regulator. So it's a political decision. It's also a decision-making process engineered and orchestrated by the politicians.
You're right. The government will be appointing the chair and has already appointed the COO. But that happens, there is a process that the government has to follow in terms of governance in making all these appointments. And there are many organisations, authorities, where this process is followed and it works very well.
Lucy, thank you very much indeed. What about your son? Is he a big Pochettino fan?
So he's a big fan of everything. He was very disappointed. We went to the Carabao Cup. Very disappointed that Chelsea didn't manage to beat Liverpool. Beat Liverpool there, but we're looking forward to the next match against Man United and see whether we can win that.
Lucy, thank you very much indeed. Lucy Fraser, Culture Secretary, joining us live on the day that the Football Governance Bill is being introduced to Parliament.
Download, stand well back, listen. Outspoken with White and Jordan. from the world's biggest sports radio station, Talk Sport.
We wanted, and we make no apology for it, to turn our attention to this, an extremely significant announcement in the world of sport. Because Dame Laura Kenny, Britain's most successful female Olympian, has announced her retirement from cycling. Laura, what did she do? She won 5 Olympic golds and 7 world championship titles in her cycling career. She became the first British woman to win a gold medal at 3 consecutive Olympics and is the most successful female cyclist in Games history. And I'm delighted to say she must be exhausted, but she's here this afternoon alongside Simon and myself. Dame Laura is in studio. Good afternoon to you.
Hello.
Hello. You are making the news in a very big way. I look up a little time ago and I see you on my monitor up there. I see you on my television up there. You're having a big day doing the rounds in the media world. But how are you feeling that the announcement, Laura, is out there in the public domain?
I mean, relieved more than anything, I think, to be honest. I mean, I made the decision 10 days ago, really.
And yeah.
It's just been like, I haven't been able to be openly honest about it, you know? And so after yesterday, it felt like a big weight had just gone. And I was like, oh, I can finally tell everyone what my plans are.
Yeah. I mean, when you hear the list of achievements that I just read out, I mean, what is your overriding, pardon the pun, but what is your overriding feeling as to what you actually did? I mean, do you sit and pinch yourself and you think, geez, oh, I did actually achieve all of that?
I mean, yeah, like, it doesn't feel like my life. Like, honestly, it's weird. If you told that 15-year-old girl who started to take it seriously, you're going to go on to win this, and then you're going to have a knighthood at the end of it, I would be like, no, that's not me. Like, that's someone else's life. And so it just feels really surreal. But I think, right, as British people, we never say, oh, good job, enough. And, like, I can honestly sit here and look back and say I'm genuinely proud of, like, the career that I was able to maintain.
For sure. And we're proud of you. You know, that's music to your ears, isn't it?
Very much so.
A British athlete, an English footballer, boxer from these Isles. All falls into that category.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do have a tendency to overpromote people, and I also have a tendency to build people up so we can knock them down.
Yeah.
But also,
yeah,
when someone is elite, like this young lady is, then you have to call it for what it is and say that this is an elite sportsman that should be celebrated and given all the praise that goes with the achievements that she's brought to herself and her sport. So absolutely right. And they should be said, people should be saying good job.
Oh, well, thanks. Done. Thank you.
The thing is, Laura, you were still trying to meet Paris and the Olympics.
Yeah.
In fairly recent times. So what really clinched it for you that, no, now is the time to step back?
Well, obviously, I've had two different paths here. I had my first son before the Tokyo Olympics, and I was so fully committed to go into another Olympic Games, and I'd have just made anything happen. You know what I mean? I was moving hurdles out of the way all over the place. I was having to re-qualify myself, and I was just really, really determined. But when Monty came along, it was just a very different process I was taking. Like, I found myself wanting to be at home a lot more. They would come in before any training session. I wasn't like on the phone saying, Mom, I need help. I need just to look after the kids because I'm going out for 4 hours. I was just avoiding that conversation. And then the more we got talking about this Olympic qualification and how it ends in April, felt like the time was running out, you know, and I was having to make a decision on whether I wanted to go to the Olympics, whether I wanted to go to the World Championships. And I honestly felt like that 15-year-old again, where my tummy was like turning in knots because I just did not want to leave the boys again. And so that to me was warning signs that I think you're probably coming to the end.
I mean, motherhood and being a top sports person, I mean, how do the two marry together? Because it's a bit of a shift, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I call, like, Jason and I are organised carnage. Like, at home, it is just, like, utter mayhem. And we're so last minute with things. I mean, we joke about ringing the parents. I've had times where I'll ring my mum at 6 and I'm like, can you be round at 7? Because we're going for a flight to Mallorca. And she's like, you're having a laugh. But it did work. But I do think that Jason and I painted this really pretty picture and made it almost look easy. And it wasn't, like, it wasn't. Juggling the both was really quite difficult. And, like, yes, Jason and I were in a very unique situation that we were both doing it. So it wasn't like I was just leaving the kids at home with their dad. I was either leaving them with the grandparents or they were having to come with us. So it was unique and it was difficult, but we made it work, and I was willing to make it work, you know. And I think that was the different, that was the biggest thing between the two, like, comebacks, was one, I was very much willing and I wanted it to happen, whereas this time I didn't really want it to happen.
I'd love to see all the medals, like, goodness knows where you keep them, you know, what it looks like. 5 Olympic gold, 7 world championship titles. I mean, unreal. It's brilliant. What is your favourite standout moment in your career? There have been so many, and I've loved watching you over the years. Many people have. Lots of people at Sky talk about you for what you did for British sport in general. What's the standout memory that you think, that was the one, they'll never take that away from me?
Oh, London 2012. I mean, it's pretty unique, isn't it, to have a home games and then you go to win your first gold medal too. And so, like, nothing will ever take that first medal away from me. Like, just the girls, like, so it was obviously me, Danny and Joanna, because it was the team pursuit. The amount of work and time that went into that medal was just insane. Like, we literally lived in each other's pockets for 18 months, you know, and for it to come off, and we did almost perfect a team pursuit. Like, that doesn't happen very rarely, let alone at a home Olympics, you know. So that one, yeah, for me is, yeah, my favourite.
I remember being here and going to the London Games, and it was special. But does the legacy of those games live on, Laura? Are they what I still think they are, or in the eyes of many, has it diminished a bit, the London Games?
I mean, obviously the tagline was inspire the next generation. And I do feel, I mean, I can sit here and easily talk about that from the cycling's point of view. And the amount of numbers of people that actually got on bikes and the amount of number of females that got on bikes after 2012 was incredible. Like, it really did give it a boost. But I do think, you know, to keep that going for female sport, we're on a massive upward mountain at the minute because of what the Lionesses are doing. And I feel like we do need that pumping back into cycling again at the minute. And it would be good, you know, well, the Olympics is coming around, so it will happen. Like, so we will get that boost. But we do tend to run in 4-year cycles, I think, with how, like, so it will be, we're on the telly, there'll be a boost in people getting on bikes, and then it dips again, and then it'll be like, oh, they're on the telly again. And that's sort of how cycling works.
See, I think that's such a great point, Simon.
Well, it's a bit like tennis in this country, but it's undeniable. I suppose Sebastian at length about the 2012 Olympics and the effect of it. And look at the medal totals that are projected into this next set of events.
Yeah.
We're talking about being at the top of the leaderboard now, whereas once upon a time, we were nowhere in that conversation. So whilst there can always be more effect, whilst the effects can be longer and lasting and more significant at times, you cannot deny that the 2012 Olympics was a success for all aspects of Olympic sport, and that the legacy of it is producing better athletes competing at better levels and medalling.
Yeah.
Repeatedly.
Yeah. 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 No, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I just think, because of how much negative, like, energy was around pre that games happening. And then when it happened, it was just phenomenal, really, what an Olympics can do to a country.
Mm. Yeah. There's a message there, Laura. You don't need to go into any great detail. It was Terry. What actually, asked Laura, what actually goes on in the Olympic Village? You know, any saucy stories for us? I don't know what Terry's thinking about there. He's taking us in a totally different direction.
I mean, it's really weird being in Olympic Village. I always describe it as being in a Big Brother house. It's like everyone's looking in, but you can't look out because, like, you don't see anything. Like, there's no newspapers or anything in there, so you don't actually know what is going on. And we didn't really go on social media and stuff either because it was very much, you know, you're keeping your team as your team. But I mean, beforehand, honestly, when you're in the Team GB building, it is the most surreal building to be in. You've got so many athletes who are at the pinnacle of their careers
of course,
their sports.
Yeah.
And, like, you're bumping into, I mean, I bumped into Andy Murray in the lift. And you know when you're like, what? Like, it was just so random. And then you've got Tom Daley who comes back with his medal and you're like, what is happening? Like, what sort of weird world am I living in?
Yeah, but Andy Murray's saying, well, I bumped into Dame Laura Kenny in the lift. So, I mean, that's how it works out. When you look at athletes, and you've seen them all around the world, but is there one who stands aside and that individual inspired you?
Well, I was lucky that Dame Kelly Holmes obviously competed at the Olympics and won her 2 gold medals right as I was getting into sport. And I never looked at her and thought, oh, I want to win 2 gold medals. It was never that. It was just the fact, it was the shock factor that that was impressive for me. I mean, I was, what, 16, I think, at the time. And it was just the fact that when she crossed the finish line, she was, like, genuinely like, what have I just achieved? Like, she was shocked, and that just sticks in my head. And then I was like, wow, like, I want to go to the Olympics.
Of
like,
course, of
I
course.
I want a feeling like that.
Yeah. Many messages coming in, Laura, not just Terry, who was asking us about the Olympic Village stories, but there are 1, 2, 3, 4 in front of me just saying, pass on to you a huge debt of thanks that people feel for what you did. And of course, what you did on a regular basis for your sport and for everybody here in the UK. Dame Laura Kenny is with us live here on Talk Sport.
The world's most dangerous download. Outspoken with White and Jordan. From the world's biggest sports radio station, Talk Sport.
Thanks for listening to Outspoken with White and Jordan. Please leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast from. We're back tomorrow to bring you the best of the show.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.